Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Scientists made 50-year-old skin cells behave like they're 20 again. Researchers at the Babraham Institute in Cambridge have developed a groundbreaking method to reverse the biological aging of human skin cells by approximately 30 years, all the while keeping them as fully functional adult skin cells. The team used a carefully controlled, modified short-term version of the Nobel Prize-winning Yamanaka reprogramming technique. This technique allowed for the formation of pluripotent stem cells, which otherwise were having to be harvested from embryos. And so it was a very big deal that we could make as many pluripotent stem cells as we wanted using Yamanaka's techniques, a series of chemicals that are fed to the tissue culture over a period of time. In this case, by exposing adult skin cell fibroblasts in a dish, basically, for just 13 days, and then stopping the Yamanaka process early, they successfully reset many of the molecular markers of aging without pushing the cells all the way back to a stem cell state. So these were still fully differentiated.
No, I'm a skin cell. I know it's my identity.
But they were still looking like they were 30 years old rather than 50 years old, or 20 years old rather than 50. The rejuvenated cells also acted like they were 20. They displayed a dramatically younger profile. Their epigenetic clock, which is a measure of chemical tags on DNA that tracks closely with biological age, and their gene expression patterns closely resemble those of the cells of much younger individuals. Okay, good. They look good on the surface, but more impressively, the treated fibroblasts produce significantly higher levels of collagen, the protein essential for skin firmness, elasticity, and wound healing. Plus, they migrated faster to close an artificial wound in laboratory dishes compared to untreated older cells. The researchers in doing this also observed the reversal of age-related changes in genes that have been associated with diseases such as Alzheimer's and cataracts, suggesting that the technique could have broader therapeutic implications. Now, this work is still in its early stages, and I have no idea of the toxicities of the compounds used in the Yamanaka protocol. But I could see how this could be done to rejuvenate blood cells. And we already have data that shows that when you transfuse a mammal with blood or even just plasma from a younger mammal, you get a rejuvenation effect, getting rid of the old senescent cells, or at least allowing them to be destructed. We don't understand what we're doing. We just can do it. Now the question is, might we someday be able to rejuvenate aging cells in the body to enhance tissue repair, or even potentially slow or mitigate some effects of age-related diseases? Well, it's a long and hard road, research-wise, to get there from here, but still a really, really interesting and creative use of existing technology. Last week, I responded to a question about vaping versus smoking, and I talked mainly about cardiovascular risk because that's something that happens quickly enough that we have epidemiological data. And I thought to myself, you know, I don't know what to say here about cancer. So I thought I'd kick it down the road and talk a bit about cancer and vaping this week. We're going to dive a little bit deeper into the topic of that vapes and long-term cancer risk. We don't have that epidemiologic evidence yet, but the signs are right here staring us in the face. So chronic inflammation is a key driver of carcinogenesis in e-cigarette users. cigarette aerosol exposure induces the secretion of pro-inflammatory cytokines. These cytokines are molecular signals. You'll have heard of some of them, IL-6, IL-8, maybe tumor necrosis factor alpha. And we can see the secretion of these in phlegm that the people who are vaping cough up. We can also see them in the airway epithelial cells and macrophages, the immune cells, lining the bronchial tissue and the trachea. A recent study identified something called hypopathway suppression. And I'm not going to dive into the weeds here. This basically causes hypersecretion of pro-inflammatory cytokines. And this pathway drives also genomic instability because it interferes with DNA repair fidelity. In other words, your proofreading program can't spell. This is a very bad thing. A meta-analysis of about 2,400 adults looking at biomarkers found that e-cigarette users had elevated inflammatory markers compared to non-smokers, but not as high as traditional smokers. But we know that e-cigarette aerosols themselves induce neutrophilic inflammation, increased white blood cells, airway hyper-responsiveness, sort of an asthma-like thing, and mucociliary dysfunction, which is to say that the street sweepers in the lungs are damaged and aren't sweeping the street. So garbage is going to accumulate. And let's talk about the multiple classes of carcinogens which are present in vape smoke. So we have nicotine-derived nitrosamines, and nitrosamines are very actively carcinogenic, volatile organic compounds, flavoring agents, and metals as key contributors. And the American Heart Association notes that the cytochrome P450 enzymes are upregulated in vapor's lungs. Now, that means these are the enzymes that break down compounds. And that's a problem because when you upregulate them, they are much better at turning carcinogenic, pre-carcinogenic molecules into carcinogenic molecules, especially one called benzopyrene. And that one is an especially nasty compound. Mice exposed to e-cigarette aerosol for 54 weeks developed lung adenocarcinomas in about 22% of the exposed mice and bladder hyperplasia, a precancerous condition, in about 57. These lesions are extremely rare in controls. And these findings, combined with the DNA damage and impaired repair observed with shorter exposures, well, let's just say they provide a strong mechanistic evidence for carcinogenesis. So how does vaping cause cancer? Well, there's two ways. Way number one is DNA damage and gene toxicity. Number two is oxidative stress mechanisms. So e-cigarette aerosols induce direct DNA damage. The DNA gets oxidized. And when DNA gets oxidized, it forms a marker called 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine. And this is a marker of DNA damage. You can measure this in people's blood or urine and get an idea of how much of a toxic reaction they're having to their environment. It's one of the tests that I do sometimes in patients who come to me for a functional medicine evaluation. In mice exposed to e-cigarettes aerosol for 12 weeks, extensive DNA damage was found in biopsies of the lungs, heart, and the bladder mucosa. And as is said, the DNA repair mechanisms are depressed by e-cigarette smoking. And so you can't erase the oxidative damage through the normal healing processes. Our bodies are designed to, if the DNA gets damaged, repair it. But if you also hamstring the repair mechanism, well, you get chromosomal damage, you get epigenetic alterations, you see hypomethylation of a particular type of genetic repeating element that leads to genomic instability. Those genetic repeats are there to stabilize the structure. Gene instability increases the odds of cancer across the board. In one study of adult humans, certain hypermethylated areas in the cheek cells in the mouth predicted lung cancer development odds about 22 years before diagnosis in smokers. And these same hypermethylated sites are seen in e-cigarette users. Moving to the oxidative stress generation, it's a central mechanism of e-cigarette toxicities. E-cigarette aerosols contain intrinsic oxidants and induce cellular reactive oxygen production through multiple pathways. Also, they contain propylene glycol and vegetable glycerin, neither of which are toxic until they're heated. But when you subject them to the high temperatures used in vaping, you generate something called a reactive carbonyl. Well, you may have heard of formaldehyde or acetaldehyde or acrolein. These are all known carcinogens. Acrolein, which is what kills firefighters and people who, and when we have an industrial fire or a fire where a bunch of houses burn down, the acrolein content in the ashes is extremely high. Acrolein activates a compound called NOx2, which is actually an amplifier for oxidative stress in endothelial cells. So it's like, you've got a fire, let's throw some gasoline on it. How's that going to work out for you? So the evidence suggests an adverse outcome pathway where first thermal degradation of propylene glycol and vegetable glycerin generates reactive carbonyls. This causes oxidative stress. Nicotine and other components synergistically amplify the chronic inflammation, and the suppression of DNA pathways and antioxidant defenses drives the genomic instability and increases the risk of cancer. This is a complex mixture that causes cancer through both genotoxic and non-genotoxic processes. Very, very important to understand that this is not harmless behavior. And we're going to get into medical decisions a little bit here, and I think we all need to listen carefully to discussions of genetic testing and the security of the information. Here's a pro article in Biomedicine from the January 2026 issue of Science Magazine, January 22nd, and it's about Mexico. And Mexico is a really interesting population. It's got ancestral contributions from indigenous groups, Spanish colonizers, enslaved Africans, and more recent immigrants. And in 2023, a groundbreaking genetic analysis of 6,000 people living in every corner of the country showed how that tapestry is reflected in regional genetic differences and shed light on longstanding anthropological questions. Now, the data, drawn from a national repository called the Mexican Biobank, promises to help doctors make treatment decisions. In a paper published in January in Nature Medicine, researchers linked the findings in their original analysis to common genetic variations that alter the response to medications, including fentanyl, a potent painkiller, and statins, which lower cholesterol. They report a dramatic difference across regions in Mexico. These variations are mostly driven by variations in indigenous ancestry. If you have high levels of indigenous ancestry, you're dealing with what was, in the not-too-distant past, a fairly isolated community, and so you tend to get more recessives and more sameness, if you will, in the genetic mix of the population. For a Mexican or a Mexican-American, the risk of an adverse drug reaction may be influenced by those Mayan ancestors you didn't even know you had, or your northern ancestors in the Yaqui or Pima groups. So the researchers created an online tool to make these data accessible to doctors. Knowing where in Mexico the health-affecting variants are most concentrated may also help the government prioritize at-risk populations in public health efforts. Genetic studies using a broad population category such as Latina or Mexican wouldn't pick this up. You would lose the fine detail in the averaging out process of that population. The Mexican biobank is actually very different. It doesn't have the problems of previous genetic data done in Mexico, where most of the data came from residents of Mexico City or from Mexican Americans in Los Angeles, which are obviously two populations that don't capture the full spectrum of the diversity. But this study is different. It includes more than 40,000 blood samples from all 31 Mexican states and Mexican City, and it was originally collected in the early 2000s for an epidemiology study run by the country's Public Health Institute. So for this new study, they analyzed 6,000 of the samples using a commercially available genetic array, and they looked at detoxification. Honing in on the southeastern state of Chiapas, the research determined that nearly 40% of the population carries two copies of an allele linked to lower fentanyl metabolism. This allele is called 2D6. And so in that population, anesthesiologists, without doing any genetic testing, need to be more cautious about the dosing of any opiate-like anesthetic used for surgery or used for childbirth. This is the CYP, cytochrome P450, 2D6 mutation, and it is also known to be a problem with pediatric drug overdose because children, of course, are smaller and more sensitive, and it's not rare that you start to give anesthesia to a child and you knock them way too deep because they aren't breaking it down. So older adults, bigger, have more room to absorb it and so less likely to get very deep very rapidly, although we do often run into the situation where people just take a very, very long time to wake up from anesthesia. And there are also situations where people have a different mutation of this allele and they end up burning through drugs more quickly than others. So this one in particular goes both ways. In Sinaloa, only 10% of the people share this genetic profile. They also looked at a well-studied variant of a gene called SLOCO-B1B, which is primarily expressed in liver cells. And if you have that, it's known to hinder statin metabolism. It's found in 15% or more of people from the Yucatan. And this is not trivial because in Mexico, 8 million people take statin, and poor statin metabolism confers an increased risk of side effects that can include muscle damage. You can look at genetics in smaller groups. In fact, in the United States, Sri Lakshmi Raj, who's at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York, looked at New York Spanish speakers and discovered that there were previously unrecognized subgroups. For example, one subgroup with Dominican heritage had a high frequency of cholesterol spiking variants in one group and variants that increase blood volume, leading to heart and liver failure. So this makes an argument for genetic testing. It would allow us to anticipate complications in surgery, to anticipate that we would need to give lower doses of certain drugs in individuals with certain variants. And I need to emphasize that this is not a binary thing. In each of these cases, people can have two bad copies of a gene and still do reasonably well because they have subsidiary pathways that take up the slack or because they have complete penetrance. And so the gene change just didn't take as strongly as it took in, say, their cousin. But we can't know that in advance. So there's still a lot of fuzz factor here. But it would give us a place to start. And I have fantasized for 20 years about having a gene profile of my patient that I could look at before prescribing drugs, particularly some of the stronger drugs, the ones that have what we call a narrow therapeutic range, where this variation could make a very big difference in whether they get dangerous side effects. It also would help me understand what kind of potential vulnerabilities they had and what sort of diets they would need to be careful with. For example, a vegan person who is not going to get any B12 from their diet, unless they take supplements, who had an MTRR mutation, would probably not be able to utilize the regular B12 that they'd be buying at the store. They would need a special type of B12 with just one minute biochemical difference in it that would allow them to get the benefit of it. And so they may be thinking they're doing the right thing, but not having what they actually need. Now, we have tests for that, but that's not something that's routinely done. And it's an uphill battle, let me tell you, to get the insurance to pay for it. In the United Kingdom, there is a move, and I'm not sure if it passed Parliament or not, but it was predicted to pass. I just haven't followed the story that closely. And they are going to start doing genetic testing on all children at birth, with the idea of both gaining data and also being able to identify congenital diseases, what are called inborn errors of metabolism, which we now have treatments for most of them, and being able to identify those early. Many of them cause brain damage, for example, which is not repairable. So knowing that that child, when they go off breast milk, is going to start to accumulate a toxic protein in their brain, which will cause them to be developmentally delayed if the diet isn't shifted. Phenylketonuria is one we know about, and it's common enough that we bother to test for it. But that's a matter of how common it is. But most of these, there are fixes for now. We understand the biochemistry. We have the technology, but we just don't know how to identify the people. So that's the plus side of the argument. But then you get to the minus side of the argument. This type of testing is often done in certain other countries, China being an example, when children show aptitude for certain sports in early childhood, they may be tested to see if they have certain genetics which are associated with supremely good performance in certain sports. And then that child may be essentially channeled as Olympic material into a program of education and coaching, which, you know, can be in the short term extremely beneficial, but also maybe not what the parents or not what the child would particularly want for themselves. And that's the good side of it. What about selecting against traits that might potentially make you less able to benefit from a high-quality university education? What about deciding, well, I mean, you know, you can just let your mind run away with it. This is, it's got its dark side if it's abused and used as used to create a sort of Brave New World scenario where people are essentially tracked and classified by their genetic potential. You know, I don't think any of us can imagine what that would be like because we've grown up in this country, which isn't, at least in my experience, we have certain kinds of problems. We have racism, we have economic injustice, but we don't program it in. The best you can say is that we don't fix it, but that's a different discussion, but we don't create it, and in the sense of programming it in, at least. We'll do another quick one, and then we'll go to a longer one after we do our half-hour station break. Better sleep with conscious. Many people are struggling with sleep apnea or the sleep apnea devices and the masks and the whole thing, the whole shebang. A small new study from researchers in India finds that the daily practice of blowing hard into a conch shell can markedly improve sleep for people with obstructive sleep apnea. Researchers taught half the study's 30 sleep apnea sufferers to blow into a conch and make a sound like a horn, and had the others do deep breathing exercises. After 6 months, the conch blowers were 34% less tired, had higher blood oxygen levels at night, and experienced fewer apnea episodes per hour than the others. This results jibe with others that have found lower apnea incidence among players of wind instruments, which particularly suggests that the act of blowing hard strengthens airway muscles. Also, I recall a study from easily 15 years ago. I was with another station back then when I broke that one, and that fit my news of the weird sort of tastes perfectly, because it said that playing the didgeridoo was an excellent way to cure sleep apnea. And recently, a patient of mine talked about how an acquaintance of theirs had designed a curative treatment that involved biofeedback and some sort of computer interface and biofeedback device that coached people through the exercise, and had shown that that reduced sleep apnea. In fact, the whole thing was bought up by a company. That company was subsequently erased from the world for whatever reason. And so the rights to the device had already passed into the limbo of failed company properties. But yeah, blowing on a conch shell, maybe it's less intimidating than learning to play the trumpet, but it could have similar benefits. And you're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. And while we were running that, we had a call come in, so we're going to go straight to that caller. Hello, caller. Welcome. And please give us your name and where you're calling from.
Leona Phillips from Capitola.
Hello, Leona.
You know, the question I have isn't about the topic that you're talking
about. That's all right. No problem.
But I'll put it out there for the future anyway, or if you can address it today. I'm recovering from a 9.5 centimeter non-Hodgkin's lymphoma tumor in my thigh. It was in my L5 nerve and on my L5 nerve several years ago, and I had chemotherapy and radiation and surgery. Recently, I'm having problems with the nerve again, and I came across something called Campo Medicine, K-A-M-P-O. It's Japanese, mm-hmm. and they have two possible compounds for people to mitigate nerve stress in the regeneration process and so forth. And I wondered if you know anything about Campo Medicine, or if you know of any practitioners in our area where I could possibly get the compound made for me, or I guess I could get it online as a generic, but I was sort of more interested in an individualized response.
Okay, well, I am familiar with Canpo as a company, and there are several products that I have used when I do my functional medicine cancer support for people. There's one in particular called Great Tonifying Formula, which is really great for dealing with chemotherapy side effects and fatigue and all of that. I'm not familiar with the products that are related to nerve injury, but if you so I think that we're probably talking about the same thing, and you found a website that maybe either belongs to or is promoting the products from the Canpo company.
Actually, I was reading a couple of research articles, and mm-hmm. One spoke of Gosha Jinkangan, and the other was, I probably didn't get that quite right.
That's all right.
Yoku Kansan. And I couldn't quite distinguish between the two, but I know that in the approaches, they approach it as a whole system, and that's what interests me, because I don't want to do gabapentin or something that just takes away the pain. I'd like to work on the root cause.
Well, in your case, root is such an applicable word to use here, because I think the cause of your pain most likely is scar tissue in that area pulling on the nerve. Is the pain in, well, you said it was L5, that where...
But it's in my thigh. And when I sit, it hurts.
Yes, but is it, if you stand and push on that area in the thigh, does it hurt or not? That's the key question.
It's always a little bit sore, but there are times when it flares up and it's just unbelievable.
So I think the nerve is pinned and, you know, entrapped. And so when you sit, when you bend that hip and sit, you're stretching the nerves. You're actually pulling on the nerve roots. And so anywhere along the nerve root that goes to the thigh, if something is irritating it, it doesn't have to be at the thigh level. It could be at the spinal level, or it could be attachment to the scar. So,
Or generally the other the muscles around that side of the leg.
Well, yeah, and that is possible. They could be secondarily, they could be affected by the L4 nerve root. That's pretty much what lives there. And you also have the skin innervation. So you've got the motor innervation on that same nerve that potentially is glued to some structure in there and being yanked in certain positions. So in terms of herbal formulas, I think that particularly if you're dealing with Japan or China, that you're dealing with a very established medical culture, and this can be referred to, I think, appropriately as a technology. And there are typically, these are formulas that have been derived over many years.
Thousands.
Precisely. And so it's a different way of getting to knowledge. It's not scientific method exactly. It's more of an evolutionary method, like what works survives and is either replaced by something that works better or continues to persist and get taught. The selective pressure isn't reproduction. It's transferring it into the knowledge base of the next generation. That's the reproduction of this kind of evolution. And so I think it's legitimate to try something along those lines. In terms of guidance, you probably would do best if you went to an OMD. We have a school here in Santa Cruz called Five Branches. I used to teach there.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
And I think if you started with their clinic and your questions about this, they would probably be familiar with it and could advise you. And they also have, part of what they do is they have the whole pharmacopoeia of everything from the dried powdered seahorse to every plant you can possibly think of. And they have the formulas, and they do teach the from scratch, you know, cooking from scratch sort of thing on these formulas. And I think that would be very fruitful for you to head in that direction and see what they can do for you. Also, that's one of the things where I think acupuncture can also be potentially very helpful. If you were to come come into my office, I would probably address it that way. But you may have gone down that road and had it not be successful.
Well, I did. It was misdiagnosed as sciatica for a year, and an acupuncturist at Five Branches actually put a needle in the tumor, and it took me 4 days to recover afterwards. But neither of us knew, and I asked her not to do it again, and she did. So I'm a little bit nervous. I have used acupuncture for years, but at the moment I'm thinking route would be easier.
I can understand, but this is how you could get a good, solid consult.
What would I ask for when
I think you'd ask for ask to see someone for herbal treatment of this issue.
Okay.
And so you would not be going to the acupuncture clinic. You'd be going to someone who's like working on the OMD program. And so there, if you go in Santa Cruz, that's the master's program. So you would be wanting to see faculty who is an OMD and you're interested in herbal treatments, you've read some articles and you want to explore this, bring the articles. And I'm betting that there'll be a lot of recognition, and that would be a good
place to start.
That's
great. I thought they were just doing Chinese, and I didn't realize they would also do Japanese.
Well, I don't think that those herbs actually know anything about national boundaries. And I suspect that there's considerable overlap in the formulas.
I would guess.
Yeah, I think so.
Because a lot of the ingredients sounded familiar to me. So.
Exactly. So I think that the Japanese, you know, formulas, like the Japanese have acupuncture. Probably they got it from the Chinese during one of the periods when the Chinese were occupying Japan, which has over the last 5,000 years has happened a number of times, and vice versa once or twice. So, there's a lot of cultural mixing.
Okay, that's great, because I just wasn't sure. I wanted to make sure that I went with someone who had experience.
I hear that.
Yeah.
And that's why that's where why I'm sending you to the local experienced people. And if you're not satisfied, then you could send me an email. You can send it to just go to AskDrDawn.com. Send me an email. Send me links to the articles. And I'll do a little work on it for you, and I'll put the answer out on the air, but I'll also send you a reply to you directly.
Okay, that's great. Is that AskDrDawn.com?
Yep, and it could be doctor spelled out or just DR, but no periods.
Oh, okay.
No dots.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate this. I'm not sure where to go, but...
Well,
now you've got
at least your first step. I'm pleased to have been able to be of help.
Thank you very much.
All right. Have a wonderful evening.
Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. So coming to a television commercial for drugs near you sometime in the next year, a snappy name, do you have... LPA, or whatever the promotion people come up with calling it. Ask your doctor if you need testing for LPA. So what the heck is LPA? Well, you know about the cholesterol, the lipoproteins. You've heard of HDL and LDL. And LPA is a little tiny protein string that gets stuck onto the LDL particles. And the LPA plus LDL particles are dangerous. They tend to clump up, and that leads to blood clotting. So blood clots, of course, in the coronary arteries, we call those heart attacks. And people who have normal cholesterol and no risk factors but have LPA have an increased risk depending on the number of LPA. So, for example, if you normal levels are about 75 or less, and your average population risk, if you've got 250 particles, you've got a 200% increased risk. So you've got a doubled risk. If you've got 350 particles, you've got a tripled risk of coronary artery disease and stroke. And that starts to look like something that would be wonderful to target. Most people haven't been tested for this because we haven't had a drug for it. Some people know they have it. And pretty much what their doctors have told them is, well, take a statin because at least that'll reduce the number of LDL, true. And so that may mitigate your risk. Possibly. Actually, I don't think that's established. It's more of a St. Christopher's medal or a lucky rabbit's foot, really, because the research doesn't necessarily support it. But a good doctor wants to do something, and so that's what we do. But certain drugs are coming, and we're going to talk about gene silencing therapies now in the context of LPA lowering drugs, which are in the pipeline. I'll tell you a little bit about those specific drugs. But the thing about these gene silencing therapies is that they are very, very potentially valuable in terms of helping us treat this condition. And I mean, just amazingly important. And so I'm just taking a moment to talk about antisense oligonucleotides and small interfering RNAs. And that is how we are going to treat a whole bunch of undruggable diseases. And these aren't drugs. They're really biological agents made of messenger RNA and a few side groups. Let's start with antisense oligonucleotides. Like messenger RNA in the body, these are single-stranded segments of RNA, and the attached to them is an enzyme called RNAase H. And RNAase H degrades target molecules. So you, in the case of the LPA drugs, what's happening is it's a gene. You have the gene, you make the protein, but on the way to making the protein, you make mRNA for the protein. So the ASO is going to be the negative. Think Velcro, all right? You've got the loops and you've got the hooks. So if you think of the mRNA as the loops, you need the exact right hook to grab that particular set of Velcro. Once you've done that, the enzyme swings around. It's rather like CRISPR in this regard. The enzyme swings around and cuts the DNA that you don't want to be able to get over to the ribosome, the protein factory, and be turned into the LPA protein. The other strategy is small interfering RNA, and small interfering RNAs are double-stranded, and when they get into the cell, they need to come in via a liposome. They're not as readily entered into the cell. When they get in, there's an enzyme that opens it up, unzips it, and then the negative strand, the one that is the mirror image of the mRNA for the LPA, grabs onto it, and double-stranded RNA gets destroyed immediately. That's an error. It shouldn't exist. And the cells never, ever want to see double-stranded RNA, so they have a mechanism to zap it as soon as it appears. Either way, you've taken that messenger RNA for the LPA protein out of circulation, literally. Now, right now, there are drugs. Pelacarsen is a monthly injection in phase 3 trials. It's reduced LPA by 80%, so it'll take you down to the low-risk zone. It's being trialed for coronary artery disease. There are also injections of the small interfering RNAs. There's 3 or 4 drugs, and these are long-acting injections giving every 3 months. And there's one promising small molecular inhibitor that is oral. So we can expect that we will be seeing these coming along for LPA. And like I said, it does create a substantial risk, even though someone passes their cholesterol screen, the doctor says, you're fine, you're average risk. But unless you're looking at LPA, they may not be. We've known this for a very long time. I screen for it because I use it as leverage to get people to shift their lifestyle. If they have LPA, no, they're not low risk. They're intrinsically and genetically high risk. And when we talk about their family, it turns out, oh yeah, you know, so-and-so had a heart attack, so-and-so had a stroke. And it's they're high risk by family history, and this is why. But then they're normal on lipid testing, and so often the doctors say, well, I don't know why your dad and his father and their father died of heart disease, but you're okay, your cholesterol is fine. No, you're not. So we are advancing technologically, and this particular silencing idea, all of those inborn errors of metabolism that I was referring to earlier, we actually have a shot at treating them. And more, even better, to drive the science forward, for there's a market on these. So in terms of the LPA, there's a market on, there's a market that's big enough and juicy enough for big pharma to be developing these agents, but we can piggyback treating orphan diseases from what we learn from the production, from the research and the production and the validation and the safety studies and all the things that cost so much that nobody wants to pay for them unless they can expect to make a decent profit. I'm going to spend some time talking about vitamin K. Now, it's a well-known molecule. We're going to learn a little bit about it. There's vitamin K1 and vitamin K2. And vitamin K is abundant in leafy green vegetables. It plays a direct role in photosynthesis, so you don't get chlorophyll without it. Or rather, you get chlorophyll, but you don't get any carbohydrate without it. And it's super important in the production of blood clotting proteins. Vitamin K2 is different. It's actually not made in your body. It's synthesized by bacteria in your body. It's made in the gut, and it's molecularly almost identical, but not quite. Anyway, MK4 is the most common subtype that we find in humans, and we've talked also about vitamin K2, MK7, 8, and 9 because of their propensity to help with putting calcium in the bones and keeping calcium out of the arteries. And I recommend the MK7, 8, and 9 to stabilize coronary calcium. So if you have coronary calcium on a, if your coronary calcium score is not zero, you should probably be taking a couple hundred micrograms of MK7 to try and stabilize those plaques. Is there data in humans that it prevents heart disease? No, but it's likely that it makes a difference. It'd be very hard to prove because we don't have the technology to monitor the calcium in the arteries and say for sure that it's leaving. But MK4, the one that is the most common, it has recently been shown to help prevent liver cancer. In this case, there was a study, two groups that were at high risk because they had either hepatitis B or hepatitis C. They were about the same age. It was good control. They had roughly the same level of liver damage and other clinical findings. And so they gave vitamin K2, MK4, to this group, and as the first study commenced, they found hepatocellular carcinoma in 2 of the 21 patients in the MK4 group and in 9 of 19 patients in the control group. And the cancers were smaller in the treatment group, and that was statistically significant. And all the diagnosed cases were stage 1 or 2, so they were earlier. And so on an analysis, when you look it all together, we call it a univariate analysis, the risk ratio for the development of hepatocellular cancer in the treatment group was 0.2 compared to 1.0 in the control group. So this is a pretty, pretty substantial difference. And so they've investigated the anti-tumor effects. And just in the dish, when you put vitamin K2 in a petri dish with hepatocellular carcinoma cells, it activates something called protein kinase A, and it inhibits the invasiveness and the growth of the HCC cells. They also demonstrated that certain genes were turned on, and these genes were exclusively turned on by the MK4, and they think those were related to the decrease in growth. So we find ourselves another target. But another interesting function of MK4 in this particular situation was it induced apoptosis, that is to say, cell suicide in cancer cells. And so this enhancement of apoptosis, which is one of the things that cancers have to block, because the cell normally, when you get a traitor in our midst and the cell becomes cancerous, the cell itself, the mitochondria, signal cell death. They signal, okay, time to go. We self-destruct 10, 9, 8, so on. But that self-destruct function is inhibited by cancer cells. They turn it off. The vitamin K, MK4, actually turns it back on. So if you're at risk, let's say you've recovered from Hep C, that gives you lifelong risk for hepatocellular carcinoma, and you should be taking some vitamin K2, a couple of milligrams would be my recommendation there, because you can't overdose on vitamin K2, and you want to achieve doses, you want to achieve a fairly high blood level, and I think, in order to get this cancer prevention benefit. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.